Hello, and welcome to Season 5 of Human Awareness, the official podcast for High Global, where we take you on a journey through love, intimacy, and sexuality. I'm your host, Haya, and I'm inviting our guests to open their hearts and their experience so we can all learn together. Okay, with that out of the way, let's roll tape on our interview.
Hello, and welcome back to Human Awareness. I'm joined today with a new friend of mine who has a really interesting angle into some of the topics we talk about a lot at High and sometimes keep forgetting about. My dear friend, would you introduce yourself and tell me your pronouns?
Yeah, my name's Kari Sullins. I use she, her pronouns. And I have a twisty background, but I started my working life into the world of venture capital and startups. And I think had this moment when I was talking with founders where I felt like I found my people, just felt like maybe deep down in me, even though I went through this clinical journey, I was actually an entrepreneur. And so I've applied all of my sort of academic and clinical knowledge into the world of entrepreneurs for the last few years.
Beautiful. And so what I imagine when I hear that is that you work with a lot of people who are in pretty intense jobs. And the trope is that all entrepreneurs want to change the world. But I think realistically, we all have this drive to want to have an impact and put a little dent in this planet of ours.
Yeah, I was thinking about this morning. I think part of the reason that I felt so attracted to entrepreneurs as a group of people is because even though I think what you said is true, that almost all of us, I think, want to make a dent in the world, entrepreneurs are crazy enough to believe that they actually can. And all of us have, and I use the word crazy with a really like full heart and admiration and like recognition in myself as well, which is that for whatever reason, our family patterning and the environments that we came up in gave us tools or mental structures that somehow communicated to us that we're the ones that need to change the world.
I feel like as an entrepreneur myself, hearing a clinical psychologist call a group of us crazy, that's okay, now I'm leaning in. This is going to be interesting. I think there's some truth to that. And I think in particularly for entrepreneurs, what I'm often seeing is that the people who believe enough in the ability to make change are also, like, I've been through burnout after every single one of my startups, and it has been brutal. I was just in Norway for a startup conference and somebody said to me, it was like, hey, when are you doing your next company? And I took a deep breath and I was like, there's a moment here. I get to be honest or I get to come up with some sort of flippant answer. I was like, you know what? No, this is the time for honesty. And I looked him straight in the eye and says, I don't think I have the mental health for doing another startup. I think it will break me. The last few almost broke me and I don't know if I can do it again. And I got this stare back of like, oh, that wasn't the answer I was expecting. And I was like, here we are. Like, I'm showing up in my full self and let's see how that goes. And my impression is that a lot of the people you work with are striving towards that as well, to show up, to bring their full humanity and their full selves to the work day.
It's interesting the way you put that. One, I want to just, I think, commend your bravery there, because I think it is really hard to tell the truth. And maybe in any group, but I see this so profoundly with entrepreneurs that they're, because there's this dedication to changing the world or doing something bigger, or maybe there's a belief that I'm special or I've been parentified, so I feel like I have to do it because no one else will, or whatever that narrative is for every entrepreneur, it presents a trap, which when there's a moment of vulnerability available, the entrepreneur or probably all of us as humans get stuck in that trap. And what you did was overcome the trap to say, you know what, there's a moment here for me to be my true, honest self and maybe taking a risk. But I would say that most of the entrepreneurs that I'm working with who are actively still in their startups are not ready to tell that kind of truth. There's something dangerous about that. It feels like it might kill their ability to make the impact that they hope, or it might ruin other people's confidence in them. I think what I've been hearing from people is that they don't even want to tell that kind of truth. Maybe deep down, they feel it. They want to be seen. They want to be known. That's why I get hired. But to say that publicly at a startup conference might feel even unfathomable to someone who's in the midst of their startup.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I think for me, that what that ties into is my journey with neurodivergence. I recently discovered that there's a pretty good chance I'm autistic. And as part of that, of course, I spend a lot of my time masking. And so being aware of that means that I get to choose when I mask and when I don't. I can bring my full truth. And I think that is the way that people are able to really connect at a much deeper level.
And it gets me really excited to hear you say that, because I do think that's, even though products change the world, I think actually the reason that I'm really invested in startups in particular is that they can change the world through an interactional capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And I sometimes say this, that I like to partner with jet skis, not cruise liners, right? And the jet ski being the startup company, because you can turn them around on a dime because they're so small and nimble and meant to pivot, right? They're designed to change. And so sure, we're doing that for the product, we're doing that for commercialization, but why not also do that for culture and the way that people interact within startups? Why not use that as the canvas to paint a new world of relationship with work?
Yeah, totally.
Not a place where you put on your work mask when you walk into the office, but a place where humanity actually can go to heal. Why not?
And how do you tease that out of someone?
It's such a big question because everyone's path is so different. But I would say that the place that I'm starting with people is in their own desire to be known. And it's just like parenting, right? In fact, I use a lot of family metaphors in the work that I do. But kids, when they're learning emotions, for example, they have to see it reflected back to them first. So kids aren't just inherently aware of their own emotions. They learn emotions by having it reflected to them by somebody else. And that means usually it's a parent, right? And many of us ended up in all sorts of funky life situations because our parents didn't mirror back our emotions correctly. Say we were sad and our parents didn't want us to be sad. So instead they came back and they said, look at the bunny. Now we're confused. I'm sorry, right. Am I sad or am I entertained? I don't know.
What does that reflecting look like?
To a child, I might actually just mirror exactly what I'm seeing in the child. So if they've changed the tone of their voice, if they've changed the shape of their face, I would mirror them. So if they're looking sad, I might say something like, oh, when you're like that, it makes me feel sad. Do you feel something in your stomach? Right? You might say something like this, but you're mirroring the thing that actually gets felt by the child is the change in your face and the change of the tone of your voice. So you could actually say nothing and just make a cooing noise, right? That tells the child, hey, I'm with you and I'm validating your feeling. And entrepreneurs need the same thing to learn what it's like to be vulnerable. So I see my role as creating that sort of corrective or healing experience with them where they can share all of who they are with me, including say, I don't want to wake up tomorrow morning and go and do my startup anymore. I wish it would fail, right? Admitting these sorts of things in a private, safe environment then starts to pave that road, create that mirroring where they then become fluent in their own experience of vulnerability and their own language of emotions and desires. And once they have that language pretty fluent and some sense of security, oh, I'm not going to be shunned or ruin my life by being who I am, then they might start to take risks like the one that you just mentioned.
You've made a reference a couple of times to what you do for a living, but I don't think we've actually talked about that yet. So what do you do for a living?
Yeah, it's actually starting to become a complicated question for me. So I'll try to answer it in a simple way, and then maybe I'll tell you where I'm a little stuck. So I mentioned that I have a degree in clinical psychology and organizational behavior. And essentially what I do for a living is smash those two things together and apply them to startups. So I operate as a coach for startups, and I like to work not just with the CEOs or founders, but with every person in the organization, which leads me to the second kind of part of what I do for a living that I think is a little complicated. I've been starting to call it systems healer. I'm not quite sure what to call it because I don't know if it completely exists, but it's essentially family therapy for companies. So I'm interested in holding and looking at the entire system and then seeing if we can find kind of the greatest, most direct path to health for that culture and system.
Do you think there's an intergenerational trauma system for corporations?
I do.
Say more. I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, I definitely think that there is a there's a legacy of trauma in individuals, right? And sometimes sometimes when I'm working with an individual, I think about it also as a systems healing. So I see that I'm holding someone's internal community, and the internal community has been shaped by their genetics, their experience, the history of their family, right? There's all sorts of, I don't know if you've read the book Emotional Inheritance. So this book is one that I think of constantly when I think about working with an individual. But I believe that the same thing that she's talking about in that book, which is that we inherit, right, almost like in our DNA, we inherit the kind of trauma of the people who came before us. Of course, the same things happen in organizations, because organizational cultures are basically woven threads of experiences, right? Culture is built by just the doing of things all day long with people. Yeah. And it's an amazing thing that people tend to conform to the same kind of fabric of the way we do things. And as they conform to this fabric, then it creates a culture. Now, you may have a culture that renovates and changes over time, but threads of that culture will persist. And the foundational threads of the culture are actually from outside of the company. So what's the startup culture? I live in the United States, so we think about what's the American relationship to work that's going to get woven into the culture if I'm a female leader. So what are the understandings and experiences of women in my society that's going to get woven into my company culture? So of course, like any experience or trauma that exists already becomes a part of that foundational fabric of the company and gets built upon that.
That brings up a whole bunch of stuff for me. I'm not from the United States, but the way the US deals with paid time off, maternity leave, the general patriarchy in terms of who is allowed, and using the biggest bunny ears as possible, who's allowed to be in positions of power and hold opinions and stuff like that. And even if you start from a completely blank slate, you walk into the room carrying all of that. And then comes your own personal grief case. And then comes all the other stuff that comes with it. And like on day one, you just founded a company and you already have all these baggage just in the back there as you're driving around with you. Yeah. That's really interesting to me. I think the other thing that pops up for me here is that occasionally you hear these narratives like, oh, we're a family. And I'm like, have some boundaries. You're not a family. If you need to fire someone, you'll fire them. So it's not a family. I feel like the other extreme is also not right. They're like, okay, I'm just here to do my job. Somewhere in between those two extremes is, I think, the platonic ideal. And here we are in this cave looking at this flickering shadows going, okay, what are we meant to be looking at here? Do you have a view on what is the, is there a right answer, or is there just right answers for the particular company that constructs you're in?
I'm giggling in my head because I started a company with my sister, which is absolutely the most complicated way to answer that question, which is, yes, it is family, and yes, it is business. And if my sister were to need to fire me, or I were going to need to fire my sister, we would have to do that and still go home at the end of the day and still be each other's sisters. And so I guess what I would say is I'm not thinking of it right now so much as a spectrum, but as two different dimensions that are stacked on top of one another. And what I say sometimes to the leaders I work with is that it is not optional for you to bring your family shit to work. It just will show up with you because it is who you are. And so if you were a parentified child, that means you were made to be a parent earlier than you really should have been, then you might have developed a worldview that I know best, or I need to lead. No one else is going to step in. That will show up with you to work. Even though it happened when you were 6 years old, even though it might be happening in your family at home where you actually are the parent, the minute you walk in to your workplace, even though it's a place of work and in business is business, somehow that whole family history and constellation walks in the door with you. So yes, it's business. Yes, you'll need to fire people. No, it's not a family, in my opinion. And yet you will put all of your family stuff right into your company, and that will also play out. And yes, you will come to deeply care for people in your business if you're paying attention.
Totally.
We just are built for that, and it will happen. And
it's almost per definition, right? You're spending so much time with someone that one way or the other, you're going to build up something.
Yeah. Yeah. We have a member of our team right now who has some pretty big family stuff going on. And we on Fridays, our team has lunch and we do something fun, like we play a game or we chit chat about stuff. It's meant for non-work stuff. And it's just an hour a week. And so one of our team members was obviously coming in with quite a bit of heaviness, given what was going on in her family. And we spent a good amount of time talking through that and supporting her and strategizing both around what she's going to do about work, but also supporting her and loving her as a person who's in our lives. I was telling another colleague about that later, and he said, have some boundaries. That's not appropriate at work. And I felt that. I was like, oh, maybe he's right. Maybe I don't have good boundaries. So I did some reflecting on it, and here's what I came up with. If something walks in the room with someone, talking about it is not having bad boundaries. It's acknowledging the whole of the person who walked in the room.
Yeah.
If I'm like digging around doing my therapist thing, trying to dig up people's old past traumas and bringing them into team lunch,
totally,
that's a different thing.
I guess there's a difference between somebody walking in with a dog on a leash and saying, hey, introduce me to your dog. Or that's different from saying, hey, where's your dog?
Exactly. That's a beautiful example.
Yeah. And I think there's something to that. I had a company at some point where we were at a trade show in Germany, and one of my employees, his grandfather just died, like literally 10 minutes before.
Oh.
He just got the phone call. He came walking in. He looked broken. And he was just like, my dad just died. And I was like, would you like a hug? Yes. And I held him for a bit. I was like, oh, shit. It's a UK company. You don't touch on it. It's not okay. But in that moment, I was like, I am here as a human being. This guy looks forlorn. And I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say, but I can offer a hug. I talked about it later, and he was super appreciative of it. But that was definitely one of those moments where I was like, if I show up as a human being in this moment to somebody who I know really well and is a friend, I will offer a hug. But he is also my employee. And now I'm like, did I overstep? Was that okay?
And what's running through my head is, as you're saying that, is I wonder if there's a reason why companies got set up with this kind of, it's just business, or even the idea you don't touch people, don't ask them about their personal lives. I imagine that these kinds of rules got set up for a good reason. And one of the things that popped into my mind is I was chatting with a client the other day, and he's had to fire a few people on his executive team. They're not bad people. They're not doing a bad job, but the company needs something different, and he has to let them go. So it's not like it's one of those breakups, for example, where it's like the relationship is great, but you're just not feeling it. You're like, oh, I really love this person, but it's just not going to work. It's a really hard kind of breakup. And he called me and he said, I both appreciate our work and I'm resenting it right now because the sort of leadership that you have me practicing, this empathetic leadership and being my full self and inviting other people to, makes moments like this incredibly hard. I actually would rather just not know and not care and just do what's needed and move on. And I understand why CEOs become callous, because this is really fucking hard.
If you set up your boundaries in such a way that there's no way you'll ever overstep, never touch anyone, never ask about emotions, never share emotions. If somebody shares emotions, you say that it's inappropriate, this is a workplace. You shield yourself from that. And I, on the one level, I get that. On the other level, I would love to live in a world where we're evolved enough and where people are able to feel empowered to speak their boundaries and to trust that those are being held, even if the person you're holding a boundary against is somebody who is in a position of power, i.e. your boss. And I would like to think that, again, this is me speaking with a tower of privilege, and I know that many of people have a very different experience, but I would like to think that it is possible to live in that world. And we're not going to get to that world unless you're willing to make mistakes and you're willing to try something.
It reminds me of something that happens. It used to happen when I was a couples therapist with couples, and now I mostly work with co-founders if I'm doing that kind of work. And I call it the empty cup standoff, which is that if both parties don't have anything to give, both parties aren't willing to take a risk, then it continues to not be safe to do. And as a leader, and the kind of leaders that I like to partner with, and the sort of leader I aspire to be, is one who takes a risk. And not only am I leading and setting a vision and a strategy and developing a product or whatever, but I'm also leading emotionally all the time. And it's exhausting, because it also means that I have to handle whatever comes back, right? If I'm speaking my truth and I'm being out there, that's hard for me, but it also allows other people to say things that have traditionally not been said because it's hard for other people to handle or hear or be with. And I'm signing up for all sorts of emotional labor to be that kind of leader and to contribute to building that world I want to live in, as you say.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the place where I show up in this is that I'm a 6'4" white dude, right? People generally are biased towards not saying no to me.
Mm.
And that's a layer of privilege that I need to bake into any of those types of interaction. If I ask somebody, hey, do you want a hug? I can't already be arms out on my way towards them kind of thing. And I mean that not just literally, I also mean that symbolically, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't think I could ever run an organization anymore where there wasn't some amount of heart openness and some amount of emotional availability from me and from the people I work with. I can't operate like that anymore.
Yeah, I would say I definitely find myself walking on the tightrope between those two worlds. And I'm sure that you have experience with this too, which is many of my clients ready or interested in, I wouldn't say not interested. I would say maybe not ready to operate a business the way that feels very natural to me. But I'm also so aware that my business will never grow to be as big as my client's business because I have to run it this way, right? That there is a limit to how fast I could scale or the kinds of decisions that I can make for my business because of that. And so I'm constantly watching too for my clients, the places where they're making decisions around how to build the sort of culture that they want, but also achieve the sorts of goals that they want to achieve. Yeah. And I think that both are possible. But as you said, there aren't a lot of role models for this, right? There isn't really a good playbook for how to become a large corporation that did so with heart. I think we pick up little threads here and there in companies that are experimenting with this. But by and large, anyone who's embarking on this journey is making it up as they go along.
What is it about the way you run your business that you think is an anathema to growth?
Yeah. And I don't know if this would be true for all people. I think it's just true for me in that I can't even go to a big party and enjoy myself. I'm like a plus or minus four people in my world person. Right. Like, I just have to say, I don't think this is true for every single person or every single business. But for me, the kind of care and depth of relationships that I have with the people in my business, I just couldn't have more of them. And what I'm seeing is that as we grow, in order to keep that culture and keep that core, the people who, say, report to me, if we're looking at a typical hierarchy structure, then need to build that kind of relationship with the people on their teams. In that way of thinking, like, this could go on and on forever, right? There's no end to what kind of scale could happen here, but the speed at which it happens and the amount that I personally can be involved because of the way that my personality works just has to be different than some of the other models that I've seen. So I don't think that they're in opposition to one another. And I believe that there are people, maybe a more extroverted leader would be able to scale up those kinds of relationships and build a culture of vulnerability much quicker than me. I completely believe that's possible.
There's something really interesting there, which is around cultures in general. If you go from 10 to 20 in 3 weeks, which is often what the business plans look like for these startups when they raise $10 million and they're like, okay, it's pedal to the metal. Let's hire as fast as we can. If you add one person to an org of 10, that is 10% difference, right? That 10% has an enormous influence on the company as they come in, and the remaining 90% of the company have a huge influence on them. And so this is where you can have peer learning. You can learn by example, all that kind of stuff. If you add 10 to a 10-person company in 6 weeks, there's almost no way to set culture. It just doesn't work. That, with that level of growth, you cannot. And yet, I somehow see a lot of startup founders trying to keep a culture in a company while growing at a clip where I'm like, look, even if you make culture your full-time job and you did literally nothing else, the rate you are growing, I don't think you have enough influence over what that looks like.
I have been thinking about this, and I have some dear friends who run an organization out of Detroit called Sevilla. And I think that they are the best that I know at setting culture. Mm-hmm. And they study organizations like the Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, is a beautiful example of a culture that if you go into an AA meeting on one side of the country, for me, on the United States, say on the East Coast, and then I go to one on the West Coast, they're the same. Mm-hmm. And there's not a person paid to think about culture going to all these meetings. That's not how mm-hmm. this is happening, right? I work with hypergrowth companies, so we think about this all the time. You can't micromanage culture in hypergrowth. You cannot do that, right? You can't have that kind of like pure peer-to-peer learning that creates this kind of beautiful onboarding to the culture and it stays the same. The culture becomes wild a little bit. I think about it more like growing a plant. I don't know if you've ever had a Monstera, but these plants just grow like crazy all the time. And they grow in these really idiosyncratic ways. Like they're like always going all over the place. And so I'm thinking about what can I put around this plant to guide its form of growth without harnessing it, micromanaging it, bonsaiing it. And it's the same thing with a culture. So I think about the systems, structures, spaces, even for anyone who's still working in an office. It's more like guiding a river than it is like trying to build a beautiful sculpture or something like that. It's more about putting on the guardrails and then letting the culture become wild and develop as it will within the confines that you've set.
I love that. So what advice do you have for someone who feels like they want to bring more of themselves to work? Where do you start? What does that look like?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of different places people can start. And in the psychology world, we would say you can start with awareness or you can start with behavior. And both roads tend to lead to the same thing. So you can override your discomfort and you can just go try it. So you can start with behavior. And what will happen is that the world will give you feedback. So if you go out and you just share your whole self, you did this at the conference recently, and the world gave you feedback. And that feedback will either reinforce your desire to share more of yourself, or it will shape the way that you do it to get the kind of outcome that you're looking for. Or you can start with awareness or insight. So you can understand what is it that, what kind of, we've been talking a little bit about these family stories. What makes it uncomfortable? What are the narratives that are in the way of me sharing more of myself? Mm. Who even is myself, right? Like, what do I want to share? What is my desire to share? And as you understand those things, then you might start to understand or lay a path for how to share who you are, or even rewrite some of the cultural norms that are surrounding you. For example, when I started to understand some of the cultural messages that I received as a woman growing up, then I could challenge them directly. So instead of feeling, oh, it's something about me that I'm shy to show up as a confident person, or I'm shy. I'm also quite a tall person. And I used to sit down to present, especially if there were men in the audience who were shorter than me, because mm-hmm. I got feedback from the environment that was not okay. But until I really had insight around where that was coming from, I didn't know how to challenge it. Mm-hmm. As soon as I had insight, that was part of my education as a woman, which was not to threaten a man. Then I could stand up in front and say, I'm a 6-foot tall woman. I know for some of you, that's going to be confronting and difficult. And now I've said it. So let's go forward. Right. And so that's a name that makes its right size instead of becoming something about me or something about them or something that is this amorphous, threatening experience. I was able to name it. And then by doing that, to challenge it.
I think this is where people in leadership have a particular opportunity to show allyship, or to show the change you want to be in the world, or to... Can you imagine a dude standing up in front of your room and saying, I'm sorry, I'm tall? That just wouldn't happen. And so there's this interesting piece where it's how we show up and how we choose to address things. Does that ring true for you?
I feel like I'm trying to convince people not to do all the hard work. This is not what I'm trying to say. But I want to acknowledge actually how ingrained and deep and difficult some of this stuff is when we start to want to change something. And I was just thinking about what it would feel like if a man stood up and not so much apologized for being tall, but acknowledged the influence that might have on the room. Just as you just modeled so beautifully, which is, I know as a tall man, people say yes to me.
Right.
like you might actually feel in the audience like you want right. to agree with what I'm saying based on how I look and how I present.
I actually had this happen to me in a high workshop once where part of the exercise was to say no to people. And the first day went by, the second day went by, and nobody had said no to me yet. And I got back up in front of the room and I was, hey, this is part of the exercise, folks. And I know that I'm a 6'4" dude. I know I used to be a policeman. I know I have all sorts of things that make me harder than usual to say no to. And also, I'm a nice person. So you maybe don't want to say no to me. But I challenge everybody in this room to say no to me at some point for the rest of this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to lunch and I had this lunch tray in my hand and wanted to go outside. And I was like, oh, could you get the door for me? So he looks me straight in the eye and goes, no. And walks off. And I was like, come on, now. So I was like, okay, I did ask for it. So I put my tray down, I opened the door and I grabbed my tray again. I was like, okay, cool, that one.
Got what you asked for.
I got what I asked for, thanks. But it was actually really beautiful. I was like, yeah, this feels like the dumbest place to hear that no. But I was like, no, thank you for giving me what I asked.
Part of what I think allowed you to do that is having that self-knowledge and understanding the societal norms that are creating that picture for you. And I think about leaders we need to understand our identities. Mm-hmm. And we need to understand the picture of our identity in relationship to those who are around us and do a deep study on our proximity to power and privilege. And if we're not doing that, then how can we ever take the next step? So we can never understand how people are interfacing with us or interfacing with their perception of us, right? Which might even be outside of our awareness.
I think there's an extra interesting, I know this is not meant to be a podcast about privilege, but I think there's a particularly interesting thing that happens with people who don't have a lot of privilege, but to be aware that you still have some. Like if you're able to listen to that podcast, you have the privilege of hearing and owning a device that can play this podcast. I think even at that level, or being able-bodied enough to get around, or I've been struggling with long COVID. I spent long stretches of time just sleeping because I am exhausted all the time. And I miss having the privilege of just being able to get through the day and not having to take a nap.
I'm feeling like I want to pull this back to burnout a little bit. You talked about burnout being a part of your picture at the beginning. And that's where I started my work as well, is looking at burnout. And in part because it's such an amazing combination of internal psychology, physical, systemic, right? It's every aspect of humanness contributes to burnout. And one of the things that we can do that we put in our kind of burnout proof toolkit when we talk to clients is reducing the amount of surface acting that you have to do, the amount of covering you have to do, modulating, right? That's incredibly exhausting. I think about if your true self and your surface self are really far away from one another, I think about your kind of internal conscious being is like running back and forth. And those people who have a lot of covering to do to get through their days are running marathon lengths with their little consciousness being, right? And people who maybe have more privilege in the world, their distance isn't as great. And so their exhaustion picture is really different. And I like to say to leaders that it's our job, both for ourselves, to reduce the amount of distance between our true self and our surface acting self, but also to set up environments that make that true for those around us. And to know at the same time, sometimes we do some of this work and then leaders will come to me and say, yeah, but like the women in my organization aren't giving me direct feedback. And so now it's their problem, right? That they're not having enough courage. They're not stepping up to the plate. The leader's doing all of their work and they're feeling confident. And it's exactly what you said earlier, which I think is so important to note, which is, and it's okay sometimes to make a choice to keep yourself safe. It's okay, even in an environment where someone's trying really hard to make it inclusive and make it okay to share and to be your true self and to be vulnerable. It's okay to say, actually, for me today, that is not available. And I'm going to keep showing up with my surface acting self. And so it's this amazing paradox, right? Which is we both aim to be leaders that create inclusive spaces where people can be vulnerable in themselves and fully engaged, because we know that's where people do their best work. We know those are the kind of the organizations that create a foundation for healing for society. And we know it's actually best for us too as leaders. But we also have to simultaneously hold the awareness that people will step into that as it's safe and okay for them And part of being an inclusive leader is making that okay too.
I think what this reminds me of is the incredibly insidious, my door is always open. Motherfucker, you're making me do the emotional work of walking in through that door to confront you about something. And I'm like, no, sorry, but no, like that's not how open leadership works. Yes, your door should always be open. Actually, no, it shouldn't. It should be open when you're ready to receive feedback. Like always open is also not correct, but like maybe a little bit more proactive.
One of the things that we're doing as a part of this systems healing work that I've started with a group of coaches that I work with is that we take the insights from our coaching conversations in an organization. So we like to build a team of coaches within a team, right, within a company. We believe that a system is necessary to hold another system. So we create our own miniature system within that. And one of the things that we're doing is taking the insights from our coaching conversations, make them anonymous and create themes out of them, bubble those up to the leaders, which then empowers leaders to be proactive and go to their teams. Because I think sometimes folks don't know where to start. They're saying, if you don't tell me, how will I know? At least in my training as a therapist, if I'm working with someone who has a very different identity or experience than me, I take it on myself as the more privileged person in the room to research anything that I can about them so that I have a place to start, not putting the burden on them to educate me. And I think it's the same in that dynamic, right? You're saying, sure, okay, you have an open door, but the onus is now on me, the person with less power, to bring something to your attention, which puts me back in taking a risk also. So what can leaders do to empower themselves to use their eyes and ears and any other tools that they have available to make sure that they can help bridge that gap and take on some of that emotional labor?
I think that is a really beautiful place to close. Where can people find out more about you and what you do?
So we have a website. It's joinpilea.com. Pilea is, we're named after a plant. That's a great place to connect.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. This has been great.
Thank you so much for joining us for our episode today. If you like the topics of the High podcast, check out our workshops. We do them online and in person. Learn more on high.org. That is HAI.org. See you soon.